morning, ladies and gentlemen. First case for argument this morning is Sullivan against CUNA Mutual. Mr. Dabowski.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. I represent the plaintiffs in this case. This is a case that is representative of a broken promise. The plaintiffs lost what in many cases amounted to well over $100,000 apiece in money that they had earned to finance their retiree health care, plus a subsidy of the percentage of their premiums for retiree health care. While defendant, at the expense of plaintiffs, gained $121 million in improvement in their balance sheet. There are two separate issues with respect to the retiree health care at issue in this case. There's the sick leave credit, and then there's the percentage subsidy. I'd like to address both issues separately. With respect to the sick leave credit, as the court is aware, we pled the sick leave credit issue in the alternative. On the one hand, we were arguing that it was a payroll practice not governed by ERISA, or anticipating the possibility of ERISA preemption, we argued in the alternative that it was governed by ERISA, but that what occurred was a prohibited transaction in violation of the ERISA law. Our primary position, though, is that the sick leave credit was a payroll practice, not governed by ERISA. And that is clearly evidenced by the fact that there was absolutely nothing in the retiree health plan, as established by CUNA Mutual, that made mention of the sick leave credit until the 2008 amendment, which abolished the sick leave credit. According to the regulations that were promulgated by the Secretary of Labor, and in particular 29 CFR section 2510.3-1, what the sick leave credit amounted to is exactly what the regulation was speaking of with respect to a payroll practice and not an employee welfare plan. An employee welfare plan is a plan, fund, or program to provide medical benefits as related to this case. This was not a plan, fund, or program to provide medical benefits. This was a program that, as ERISA opinion letter 79-48A says, was created as, and I quote, an incentive and an inducement to employees so that they do not make use of sick leave. And it was a very successful program, since many of the plaintiffs had amassed over $100,000 apiece in the sick leave credits. The other primary authority that we rely on with respect to the fact that we're arguing that this is a payroll practice not governed by ERISA is the Supreme Court decision in Morrish versus Massachusetts, where the court pointed out that a payroll practice can be identified where it involves a situation where there is a danger of defeated expectations of wages for services performed. And the court went on to say that Congress chose not to regulate such a situation under ERISA, and that's at 490 United States at 115. And that's exactly what we have here. We have defeated expectation of wages for services performed. The plaintiffs were all longtime employees of CUNA Mutual.
When the plaintiffs retired, did they have an option to take cash instead?
Only the collective bargaining unit employees. The management employees did not have the option to take cash. But they certainly worked for many years for CUNA Mutual, certainly since at least 1982 when the initial memo was promulgated, that under the belief that their continued employment and their willingness to forego sick pay was something that would create a valuable bank that they could use for a benefit that it
certainly they had that expectation, but your argument boils down to the contention that welfare benefit plans can't be changed for the worse because everybody expects that the current promises will be left in place. But the Supreme Court has held that welfare benefit plans can be changed for the worse. So there's no fiduciary duty to consider the employee's welfare when changing one of these plans. So I don't see what difference it makes. Now, I can understand the argument that if you could take cash and you decided instead to invest this money in using it to offset medical care, that that effectively hoodwinks the employees. But for people who can't take cash, this is just a dashed expectation.
Well, I think in response to Your Honor's question, we have to look at the difference between whether this is a payroll practice or whether this is governed by ERISA. If the practice is governed by ERISA, then we have to fall back on our argument that the exclusive benefit provision in the 1995 plan would have prohibited an amendment to the plan that would have taken away this credit. But if this is a payroll practice, then we fall back on Wisconsin law. And under Wisconsin law, once the employee is retired, it's unlawful to take away the benefit that they had earned while they were employed. And that's represented by the Schlosser versus Alice Chalmers case and the Loth versus City of Milwaukee case, that once they retired, that benefit was locked in for the rest of their lives. And, in fact, this court stated in a somewhat different context in United States versus Whiting, and I quote, "Diverting money earmarked for an intended recipient and keeping it in your own pocket is conversion." And that's our contention as far as what occurred here, that this was conversion. But if this sick leave credit is something that is governed by ERISA, the ERISA law contemplated that that money should have been kept in trust. 29 U.S.C. Section 1103.
Look, I think you're just confusing pension law with welfare law. ERISA requires pension funds to be kept in trust. It doesn't require any trust for welfare benefit plans. And, of course, this was an unfunded plan.
29 U.S.C. Section 1103A, Your Honor, does not make a distinction between pension benefits and welfare benefits. 29 U.S.C. Section 1103A says, except as provided in subsection B of this section, all assets of an employee benefit plan shall be held in trust by one or more trustees. And our contention is that this money should have been held in trust.
There wasn't any money. This was an unfunded plan.
It was money that the plaintiffs had earned during the course of their employment.
There wasn't any money. The employer made promises to the plaintiff, to the class, in the form of future benefits. It made promises about how much money it was likely to charge them for these benefits. But there wasn't a pot of money. It was just the employer's general assets.
The employer identified a sum of money that was attributable to each of those employees. And that sum of money could have been kept in trust, should have been kept in trust.
Thing there, right? These are accounting entries. Accounting entries aren't money. They're promises. That's different from money. Right? Is it your argument that this was a fully funded welfare benefit plan?
No, it wasn't a fully funded welfare
benefit plan, right?
It was.
Yeah.
But the employer had anticipated that the money that had been set aside for
there
the
unused no money set aside. That's where we are. Now, if there was money set aside, if you can point to where it was set aside, that would be fine. But it looks to me, look to the district court, everything I can read, this was an unfunded plan, that these were promises that the employer was going to fulfill in the future out of general corporate assets. There wasn't anything set aside.
I can accept that, Your Honor. There wasn't anything set aside.
I thought your point was that that was the problem.
That was the problem. The money should have been set aside. The money was credited to these individuals, and it became real money when CUNA Mutual credited $121 million to the good on their balance sheet.
I must say, I think you just completely misunderstand accounting conventions.
Mr. Dubofsky, let me ask if I could. Did you all consider and reject a promissory estoppel theory under ERISA?
We did consider it. We didn't plead it. We felt that we were probably foreclosed by the Fromm versus Equitable case mm-hmm. from succeeding on a promissory estoppel theory. Mm-hmm. But certainly there is a promissory estoppel issue inherent in what occurred here, that the plaintiffs were led to believe both by the promises made and by their election forms, that this was real money that would be used to fund their health care. And the fact that the plan indicated that no amendment to the plan shall cause any part of the plan to be used for or diverted to purposes other than for the exclusive benefit of the participants or their dependents covered by the plan gave them the protection that that part of the plan would not be taken away from them. And that's consistent with this circuit's case law in Johnson versus Georgia Pacific, where a very similar provision in the Georgia Pacific plan led this court to conclude that such a provision limited the reservation of rights clause so that the employer may not reduce benefits already credited to any employee. And clearly these benefits were credited to these employees. They saw it in black and white when they filled out the election forms.
Was there any reservation of rights on those election forms other than to change the benefits?
One of them indicated that the premium, there was some slight variation. Some indicated that the premiums could be changed. Some indicated that the benefits could be changed, which is understandable.
Mr. Dubofsky, can you direct us to any cases that have used your theory that, in essence, this was an informal or constructive type trust? In your briefs, you distinguished Sutton and Johnson on that point, but I was wondering if you could direct us to anything that provides more direct support for that theory.
I wish I could. This is a very unique case. Mm-hmm. This case does not resemble Vallone. It does not resemble Fromm. The only case that this court has considered that has some features that are comparable is the Orth case. But the issue in the Orth case had to do with the funding formula in the collective bargaining agreement. But it was exactly the same funding mechanism where instead of paying out the sick leave that the employees had not taken, it was credited to their account. And then what happened in Orth was that the employer, instead of paying their percentage that they had promised to pay according to the collective bargaining agreement of the subsidy of the premium, instead took all of the sick leave credit and paid that toward the premium.
I'm glad you mentioned Vallone, because Vallone seems to take a pretty strong stand on promises that at least look like promises of lifetime benefits. Could you address that in more detail?
No doubt about it that Vallone is very powerful precedent on this particular issue. But where Vallone differs from this case is with respect to the sick leave credits and with respect to the exclusive benefit provision of the plan, which was not present in Vallone. In Vallone, there was just a reservation of rights that suggested that the plan could be amended in any respect, which led this court to conclude that the reservation of rights trumped the promise of lifetime benefits. But here we have this restriction which limits the reservation of rights about no amendment may cause any part of the plan to be used for or diverted. And that's what we're contending occurred here. The case, which is not in this circuit, that probably is the closest to this case is the Unisys case from the Third Circuit, which has been back and forth to the Third Circuit several times, but essentially reached the same conclusion that because the reservation was not repeated in the enrollment documents, then the employees would have a right to rely on the representations that were made in the enrollment documents. That if the employer intended to maintain that reservation, that they would have needed to repeat it in those documents. Here the employees were given these enrollment documents that stated what their sick leave credits were, what their percentage of subsidy was. The sick leave credits said shall be paid from this amount until exhausted, and the subsidy didn't have any limitation whatsoever, although as I indicated a couple minutes ago, the premiums obviously could have changed, and certainly one would expect that benefits would change as medical advances proceed, and something that may not have existed in 2000 is something that becomes widely accepted in medicine today.
We know that the district court thought that the plaintiff's confusion about this was understandable. I'll just leave that as a comment, and then we'll go ahead.
I have a question, if I could. Then, as far as the union employees, they could, they had an option of taking cash.
They did have that option, and also
was that money somehow set aside in a separate fund, knowing that they could take cash if they wanted to, or did that just come out of the general fund?
As far as we know, it came out of the general assets because the case was dismissed on a 12B6 motion. We weren't able to take discovery.
So you didn't get any information on anyone else then?
Not at the point of the case where the court dismissed the lawsuit. I'll reserve the rest of my time.
I just want to have one question. And if someone left early for retirement, was there any opportunity for them to get some remuneration for what they had accumulated under this program, or did they just have to leave it behind?
I'm sorry. Are you talking about the union employees?
If they left when they're 60, and they take another job after 20 or 30 years where they've accumulated this promise or whatever you want to call it, was there any right for them to take anything with them?
It would have been left behind. The whole point of it was the incentive to stay until retirement.
Yeah, okay.
I'll reserve the rest of my time.
Counsel. Mr. Gilbert.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, counsel. The district court properly found, relying upon this court's settled precedent, that plaintiff's effort to overturn CUNA Mutual's exercise of its right to amend its retiree health plan did not state a plausible claim. And in doing so, the district court relied upon the extensive documents that plaintiffs attached to their complaint, finding that those documents made it clear that there is no basis for this case to proceed. There's just no plausible claim here, and this court's precedents are very settled, and the Vallone case is on all fours with this case. Let me start by going through just important facts to keep in mind. It's an employee welfare benefit plan, as Judge Easterbrook was discussing. There are no statutory vesting or funding requirements like pension plans for employee welfare benefit plans. The employer generally has the right to amend or terminate such plans. There is an exception for plans with clear and express, and that's a quote from Seventh Circuit law, affirmative written promises that benefits are vested. And that vesting promise has to be particularly clear if there are reservation of rights clauses in the plan. And again, Vallone talks about that. And in Vallone, there was what the court said was what could be construed as a promise of lifetime benefits in those enrollment forms in Vallone. Yet, the court found that there was no ambiguity, no need to look at extrinsic evidence, and the employer properly could terminate those benefits because there was a reservation of rights clause elsewhere in the plan, which in the terms, I think this was Judge Posner's term in the Rosetto case, disambiguated that possible ambiguous language there. And Vallone is clear law. It's been followed by this court. It's, in fact, consistent with many cases.
Why aren't the differences between this case that your opposing counsel identified sufficient to distinguish Vallone?
Because the
existence of the specific promises with respect to individual account balances, as well as
I think he said the exclusive benefit. What they call the exclusive benefit
and the
provision.
The exclusive benefit provision. Yeah.
Because, Your Honor, the provision with regard to the unused sick time is just the method that the plan, one of the two methods that the plan set forth for determining the amount of its contributions. If you look in the record, and it's in the 1982 memo that established that particular policy, which is at Supplemental Appendix 66 and 67. That's where that particular, this was something that the plaintiffs attached to the complaint. That established the, at that time, how the company was going to provide contributions to the premiums for retiree health care. And those memos set forth, the only one that's really relevant here is the one, there are two memos, one for management employees and one for union employees. Let me make it clear that there is no claim of the former union employees for based on the, any unused sick pay. There's no claim in the complaint for it, and when the amendment was made in 2008, that's the subject of this lawsuit, the former union employees who had some accumulated unused sick time were, did not lose it as a result of that amendment. So that's
that promise was honored. Is that what you're telling us?
Yes.
That was you honored it for the union employees, but not for the management employees.
For the management employees, the plan was changed, and so that
and the promise was broken.
That to the extent that they had and been previously told that that was the method used for determining contributions, that was changed. But if you look at the 82 memo, Judge Hamilton, that memo on its face makes it clear that this is not an irrevocable promise. It says in two places, this is on SA 66, in the second paragraph, it says, this policy applies to qualified management retirees who retire after a certain date, and while this policy continues in effect. Then if you look on the next page, the first full paragraph on page SA 67 begins, while this policy continues in effect, here's how the company is going to contribute to the premiums.
Would you agree with me, Mr. Gilbert, that the promise induced reliance?
I do not. If it did induce reliance, it would not have been reasonable reliance, Your Honor.
Well, most of us have mornings that we'd rather not go to work, right? We just don't quite feel up to it, right?
I think that's fair to say.
But people who have a sick leave plan generally want to save those sick leave benefits for when they really, really need them, right?
I think that's probably generally true.
And since we're talking here about a 12B6 dismissal, we can indulge some reasonable inferences in favor of the plaintiffs, right?
That's the law on a 12B6 dismissal.
And would you agree with me that one could interpret the company's promises here as having been designed to convince employees to use as little of their sick leave as possible?
I'm not sure that's necessarily a reasonable inference, because I'm not sure it's reasonable to suggest that an employee who is sick is going to go to work just to save that sick leave for some potential in the future to use it to help on a plan where he knows, based on this document, that this only applies while the policy continues.
Does the employee know that? I mean, the employer certainly doesn't want to emphasize that, and the district court found that the employee's claims here were certainly understandable in view of the promises that had been made and the promise not to amend the plan except for the exclusive benefit of the participants.
I think the employee did know that, not only because of the 1982 memo, which went to all the employees and had that language about the limiting its duration, but the plan itself, the plan that was in effect then, 76 plan, which is in the record, the 95 plan and the 2007 plan, which are also in the record, all have, in combination, moldable reservation of rights clauses, which make it quite clear that the company could change the contribution methods. And I think it's probably
what we have here. We obviously, at least taking the complaint at face value, we have retirees who worked for many years, and who, whether by choice or the fortune of good luck and good health, accumulated significant balances in these accounts that were credited to them. Right.
The management employees who are the plaintiffs,
yes.
Not all the plaintiffs.
On the sick leave account.
Given that it appears to be the case, that's what they have alleged.
Okay. Let me just put it to you this way, Mr. Gilbert. I understand your position based on precedents of this court. I'm not sure whether those are mandated by Supreme Court authority or statutory language. But the employer then reneged on those promises, for example, that were renewed at the time of their retirements. Why should the law tolerate that sort of broken promise?
I'm not here to set the policy and the law, but the law has been established.
You're arguing that this was perfectly legitimate to take $120 million out of accounts credited to these employees and put it in the for the benefit of the shareholders and policyholders.
Well, if we want to get into the policy behind it, which mm-hmm. appears to be the question you're asking, one of the policies behind ERISA and the ERISA welfare benefit, particularly in the welfare benefit plan area, is to encourage employers to provide these benefits. There is nothing in ERISA or any other law that requires employers to provide mm-hmm. welfare benefits. And one of the – in ERISA, there are no funding requirements for welfare benefit plans. There are no vesting requirements for welfare benefit plans in ERISA itself. And part of one of the reasons for that is to encourage employers to provide those plans. So the employers are given the option of being able to amend or terminate completely welfare benefit plans, which is clearly the law of the Supreme Court and everywhere in this country, and certainly the Seventh Circuit, as a incentive to provide these plans. CUNA Mutual knew, like every other employer in this situation, and as I'm sure Your Honors have seen from the briefs here and the jurisprudence of this court, there have been many, many cases involving the same issue. The employers knew when they provided these benefits voluntarily that they'd have the option to amend or terminate them if situations changed. And indeed, one of the reservation of rights clauses in this situation, the one in the preamble to the 95 plan, expressly says that it was the understanding of CUNA Mutual and telling the employees that situations might change and financial situation may be such to need to change this. So there is a policy reason behind allowing mm-hmm. this. And the issue is whether or not there was adequate notice given and disclosure given to the employees that this was something that could change. And if you look
would you agree with me then that these sorts of promises for future benefits are essentially written in disappearing ink?
For welfare benefit plans, that is what the law is.
And that no employee, under your theory, can even reasonably rely on the sincere, honest, explicit written promise of his employer.
There have been, in fact, in this case, this employer is better than most if you look at the cases, in that the promise here very, very expressly stated that this was only as long as the policy remained in effect. There have been cases which don't even have that language where employers, consistent with the law of this country, terminated or
as determined by the Supreme Court.
As determined by the Supreme Court. The Curtis Wright case says that welfare benefit plans can be amended or modified at will. And as it ERISA itself, determined by Congress. Congress has no, unlike pension plans, which have vesting requirements, anti-cutback requirements, funding requirements, lots of things to protect them from these kinds of cutbacks. These welfare benefit plans are different, and the law is different with regard to them. And the policy behind it is, I believe, what I expressed, that it's to encourage these voluntary plans to be made.
And then broken.
Well, no. Nothing's broken here because there's no irrevocable promise here.
What about the promises? What about the promises that are made in the election forms? There wasn't any reservation of rights at that point, was there?
In that form.
At that point, the employee's reliance is complete, right?
At that point, the employees, you're talking about the enrollment forms that employees get when they retire.
The option form, yes.
Yeah, the option form. That is just an enrollment form for the plan. It's part of the plan. The plan expressly incorporates the enrollment forms at various places in the plan. It's mentioned, and I think those sites are in our brief. I can give them to you. And enrollment form, and Vallone had enrollment forms as well. If you look at the Vallone case, there were separate enrollment forms there. This is a normal practice. If you look at the enrollment form, it is not in and of itself, any kind of a contract or a plan. It's just an election form, group health election form. One does not know, unless one goes back to the plan, what it is.
I'm looking at what it says. This is Mr. Olson's. My 60% monthly contribution will be deducted from my estimated sick leave dollar balance, $145,000, $443.08, until it is exhausted.
That's what it says in it.
And that's the promise from the employer, right?
At that time, that was what the employer said it would do. But what Vallone teaches us is that what that doesn't say, it doesn't say until it is exhausted and this promise is irrevocable. There are situations and there are cases where there is language to that effect. And what this court's law says, which my client certainly had the right to rely on, and the settled precedent here, is that this kind of language, which is not as strong as the language in Vallone. In Vallone, the enrollment form said, you're going to get these benefits for the rest of your life. To me, that's even stronger than until it is exhausted. It doesn't matter. It's the same type of a promise of an extended duration of that benefit. The court said in Vallone, you have to look at the entire agreement, not just the enrollment form, but the agreement that enrollment form comes out of, which is, and when you look at that and you look at the reservation of rights clauses in that form, you can in the plan itself, there's no question that this is not an irrevocable promise. And that's the difference between an irrevocable promise and just a promise that this is what we're going to do. And in fact, what it is this is what they did, and it's not in the record. I assume Mr. Olson from 2001 until 2008 was able to use that amount until it was changed. The other thing here that makes this case even stronger than Vallone in many cases is that 1982 memo, where when this was established in the first place, it was made clear to the employees that this only was going to take place while this policy continues in effect. Going on to some other points, this is just not a case that has that clear and express promise to vest that is required. And if you look at the cases from this court, the cases like Vallone, where there is a strong reservation of rights clause, the courts have found that there is no vesting. The key element is the reservation of rights clause. The cases that have found vesting have generally been cases when there's been no reservation of rights clause.
Let me come at it from this angle then, Mr. Gilbert. Were the unused sick leave accounts part of the plan or not?
There were no accounts there. The method of using unused sick leave to determine the amount of the employer premium contribution was a term of the plan.
There were individual credits, right?
There were accounting, some kind of accounting records, notations of how many sick days people had not used.
And the company kept track, penny by penny, employee by employee, correct?
That's what's alleged.
So were those accounts part of the plan or not? I understood your argument to be that they are part of the plan for purposes of arguing that ERISA preempts any state law claims here. Did I misunderstand that?
No, I'm not saying they're part of the plan, that the use of that unused sick pay to determine the amount of the employer premium contributions was a term of the plan and set forth in that 82 memo, and in the enrollment forms thereafter also included that. And that was something that was being done pursuant to the plan. They were not assets, plan assets.
So it's
under
part
ERISA.
Of the plan, but it's not a plan asset. Is that the distinction you're drawing?
I'm not sure for this purpose what part of the plan means.
I'm taking it from the plan language and the reservation of rights clause.
The reservation of rights clause says that the plan may be amended or modified.
Except
it has an exclusive benefit clause, which refers to a part of the plan may not be diverted or used, i.e.
Right.
a tangible part of the plan.
Well, and I know that's what the district court thought it meant. So I'm asking you, are the plan accounts part of the plan?
Not in that sense, part of the plan. Not part of the exclusive plan, benefit clause.
But they are part of the plan for purposes of deciding whether ERISA preempts, right?
I wouldn't say that those accounts are, to the extent there are accounts. What it is a balance on an accounting sheet.
Well, what else would you call it?
It's been called accounts by the district court, but the word account is not anything that's funded. The plaintiffs
How about
that.
The balances? That's your language, your client's language from the election form.
There was an accounting balance. Mm-hmm. Yes, that was.
Is that part of the plan for purposes of the exclusive benefit?
No, it's not. For the exclusive benefit clause, which comes out of the anti-annulment clause in 406 of ERISA, part of the plan would be some tangible asset that becomes held by the plan and the plan administrators. And if you look at the preamble where that language comes from, that's preamble to the 95 plan, which is at SA 22, the paragraph 6 talks about the insurance contracts. In this plan, there were plan administrators who bought insurance contracts for the retirees to provide them health insurance contracts. The premiums for those contracts came from the employer and the employee. Those insurance contracts are part of the plan. They are a tangible asset that could not be used for another purpose. For instance, the company could not somehow amend the plan to say that those insurance contracts are going to cover present employees, because this plan only covers participants. It only covers – participants are only retirees. The plan only applies to retirees. That couldn't be done. The other thing that, for instance, couldn't be done is when the contributions come in from the employer or the employee to pay those premiums, that's part of the plan. That's assets covered by this provision here, and that's something else that would be covered. It's an unfunded plan. There's not there's nothing sitting in there to back up these sick leave balances that we've been discussing. It's not like a pension plan where there's a requirement of a trust with funding. But there are parts of the plan, and the drafting here suggests that. Now, this particular provision probably wasn't necessary. It was eliminated in the 2007 plan because, being an unfunded plan, that kind of an anti-annulment clause really isn't necessary. In fact, it's not necessary because ERISA requires that, to the extent there are assets that come into the hands.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Anything further, Mr. Dubofsky?
Although the Supreme Court did say in the Curtis Wright case that welfare benefits can be amended, the Supreme Court also said in the Verity versus Howe case that lying is inconsistent with the fiduciary duty owed to the plan participants. And that's what happened in this case. There is nothing in the 1976 plan, the 1995 plan, the 2007 plan that references these sick leave credits. It was only written into the plan to take it away in 2008. This was just a method that the plan used to pay the benefits. And while the 1982 memo indicated that the funding might stop, it didn't say that the company reserved the right to simply wipe out the credits that had already been accrued at the time that that was done. Either this is an issue where it is a payroll practice, or this is an aspect of the plan, something that has some aspect of being a property right, which CUNA Mutual took to its own benefit, which violates the prohibited transaction rules of ERISA. It's got to be one or the other. It can't be neither. And for that reason, we're asking this court to reverse the district court and send this case back for trial. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, counsel. The case is taken under advisement.